Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. For 50 years, Saudi Arabia has been the untouchable oil patch ally of the United States. Since the Gulf War, U.S. troops have been permanently stationed in Islam's Holy Land. But beyond oil interests, the Saudi picture isn't pretty. No democracy, no freedom, and no love lost on America. Osama bin Laden wants U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. On this one point, could he be right? This hour, we're asking if Saudi Arabia is in fact a friend or a well-disguised foe. Should American troops be stationed in the Saudi desert? And just what are U.S. soldiers protecting there? Vast oil reserves or a hypocritical theocracy that threatens American national security? Why are we in Saudi Arabia? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I spoke earlier today with Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine. I asked him when American troops first went into Saudi Arabia.
U.S. troops went into Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Before that, there was never any question. In fact, nobody even imagined that American troops would go into Saudi Arabia. But with the proximate threat of Saddam Hussein, now 11 years ago, the feeling was something had to be done, otherwise he could threaten the Saudi oil fields. And everybody expected, I think, including the United States, that those troops would be out of there when the war was over. But they've remained, as one Saudi diplomat told me, partly as a result of inertia.
Can it really be inertia when the cost is so high? Is there something else, some other agenda that's keeping them there?
Well, there are a couple of agendas. One is to keep the pressure on Iraq. Partly, a large reason, in fact, for the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia is the failure to resolve American policy toward Iraq. Those troops are very much involved, and particularly the Air Force personnel, are very much involved with flying missions over southern Iraq in the Operation Southern Watch program that was instituted in 1992, as I recall, which is supposed to protect the Shiites of southern Iraq. It doesn't actually do that. It's not clear what that program does do these days. It's not helping to overthrow Saddam, and he's even flying some civilian aircraft between Baghdad and Basra. But that is the reason that the troops have stayed and that the American Air Force presence has stayed.
So you're saying Kuwait is too small. The problem would be the cheek-by-jowl presence of U.S. troops with Kuwaitis, though presumably if we had asked or insisted, they would have little choice but to accept them anyway, and it's not the Islamic Holy Land. And then I hear you also saying that logistically we need to be that much closer to Iraq or have that kind of absolute geographic proximity of the longer Saudi border with Iraq?
No, I think that that's part of the inertia factor. I think that the Prince Sultan Air Base is a large, isolated base where Americans can do all kinds of things in regard to Iraq and other parts of the region, but especially Iraq, that are not going to be generally observed. It has been since, for instance, since the beginning of the crisis after September 11th, the Prince Sultan Air Base has been a key logistical center and particularly a center of coordination for air operations over Afghanistan and in much of the rest of the area. But those are not large numbers of personnel who are involved in those kinds of operations. There are American bases like this and American personnel scattered all over the world doing these kinds of things. But, of course, you don't have the sensitivity of American troops based on what many people regard to be the holy soil of Saudi Arabia.
If pride and prestige then could be removed from it, would the Pentagon see logistical alternatives that would be satisfactory?
I think the Pentagon might have a number of logistical alternatives. It could operate more out of Jordan. The relationship with Jordan is very good, and it's a lot less problematic in terms of Muslim religious sensibilities. I think that there may be possibilities of expanding operations in Bahrain, in Kuwait, and Oman has always quietly supplied a very good base of operations for the United States without anybody even seeming to notice it.
Christopher Dickey, step back with us for a moment and to look at the broader U.S.-Saudi embrace. There's been more criticism of that embrace since 9/11 than most anyone can remember. How fundamentally important is it that that go on for each country, for America and for Saudi Arabia?
Well, the United States guarantees Saudi security in the face of a lot of neighbors who are very hostile or potentially very aggressive, including and especially Iran and Iraq. So in that sense, the U.S. presence, not necessarily the physical presence, but the U.S. guarantee of Saudi security is extremely important to the Saudi royal family. From the American point of view, the essence of the relationship, as it were, is oil. And it's not a question merely of how much oil the United States gets from Saudi Arabia. That's often talked about as a question of American dependence on Saudi oil. Can we wean ourselves from Saudi oil? We did that a long time ago. That's not the problem. The fact is the Saudis stabilize world oil prices. They are the world's great swing producer. Prices go up, they can raise their production and bring the prices down. Prices go down, they can cut their production and bring the prices up. They keep the prices stable and, all things considered, very low, which is extremely, extremely useful to the United States and is what allows, in fact, most Americans to pursue the lifestyles that they have.
So, Christopher Dickey, within the realpolitik that surrounds that, does it appear to you that the United States should be or is ready to pay any price, bear any burden to keep the House of Saud in power in Saudi Arabia?
I think it is, yes. I find it hard to believe that any American government would look at the House of Saud and on sort of ideological grounds or because of an abstract notion of how much better things might be under democracy would decide to turn over and turn away from the system that's existed all this time. I think everybody recognizes that there are a lot of problems with the system. I think everybody is upset in the United States government with the way that Saudi government and Saudi individuals have supported anti-Americanism in a lot of the Arab and Muslim world. But at the end of the day, I think that there's almost no alternative for the United States, because if the House of Saud goes, the alternative is likely to be something much less cooperative with American interests. It might be better for Saudi Arabia over the long run, I don't know, but it is probably not going to play the game of stabilizing oil prices in the interest of the West and in the interest of the United States over the long term. And that is ultimately the basic security concern of the United States in that region.
So how stable is the House of Saud? How real might the prospects of a change of government be there, whether or not the United States approves of it?
Well, I think we're going to have to watch it very closely over the next year, 5 years, maybe 10 years, and hope that over that time period, a system of evolution instead of revolution can be put in place.
Christopher Dickey, finally, you've described the Saudi government as quietly cooperative in the investigation of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Explain that. How cooperative have they been, and why do they need to be quiet about it?
Well, I think they've been cooperative to the extent that they've helped a lot in identifying the backgrounds and the connections of various of the hijackers on September 11th. Saudi intelligence certainly has had a lot of assets involved with al-Qaeda, and they have used their own resources from their interior ministry to look up the backgrounds and pursue the backgrounds and the connections of the people who were involved. But they are being quiet because there is a nationalist reaction here. People don't want to believe that Saudis were involved, or if they believe that Saudis were involved, they don't want to believe that they did it on their own. They want to think that they were coerced. There's a lot of self-delusion that has been really rampant in Saudi Arabia, and the government, while it wants to disabuse people, has tried to do that in a kind of a gradual way. In essence, we have the Bush administration and Saudi friends in the United States trying to convince Americans of the value of the relationship, but we have the Saudi royal family, and especially Crown Prince Abdullah, facing similar obstacles at home. It's not a comfortable relationship.
Christopher Dickey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Christopher Dickey is the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. He spoke to us today from Paris. Should U.S. troops be stationed in Saudi Arabia? Should we protect the House of Saud and their oil at any cost? Why are we in Saudi Arabia? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Virginia is Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. He's a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Army and author of the book Fighting for the Future, Will America Triumph? He's also written about the threat that Saudi Arabia may pose to the United States. Good evening, Colonel Ralph Peters.
Good evening. I was very interested to listen to Christopher Dickey's interview. I thought he did a terrific job of summing up the conventional wisdom.
Ralph Peters, let us bring in also our very own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty from Vermont Public Radio. Jack's a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Ralph Peters, you have written a sort of a blistering bill of particulars about why the United States should not be in alliance with Saudi Arabia. You've called it the most preposterous and wrongheaded policy in American history since the defense of slavery. What's your argument?
Well, first of all, I was being kind to the Saudis that particular day. And again, Christopher Dickey did sum up Washington's attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Gulf War, I mean, if you stand back and look at it as an outsider, as a soldier, as someone who's been through much of the region and seen the damage the Saudis have done elsewhere, you know, after the Gulf War, the members of the Saudi royal family joked that they'd bought the most powerful army in the world, and they really regard us as little more than prostitutes. They've been able to buy tremendous influence in Washington, D.C., best lawyers, lobbyists, out-of-work politicians, and that's always served them pretty well. Now, I'd just like to go through a few things. Like when Christopher Dickey said that, well, after Saudi, should the House of Saud fall, mm-hmm. the alternatives would likely be worse.
It'll be an apocalypse.
Yeah, we don't know that. We don't, and that's really the councils of cowards. And right now, the situation is so bad. I mean, the House of Saud is the best illustration in the world today of Hannah Arendt's theory of the banality of evil. And while we are ostensibly there to stabilize the region and keep Saudi Arabia stable, for decades, Saudi money and Saudi individuals have been actively destabilizing relatively tolerant, liberal, secular Muslim regimes around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it. I've seen their efforts in Azerbaijan, which fortunately were Keystone Cops. I've seen it in Pakistan, in Central Asia, where they have been pretty much excluded for the moment. But they reach as far as Indonesia and the Philippines. And so you have this paradox of the United States, with our sons and daughters in uniform, defending this medieval, bigoted, ultimately hopeless monarchy, while that monarchy destabilizes the more tolerant, hopeful Muslim regimes elsewhere. They supported the Taliban even after the great show of revoking bin Laden's citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
They allowed his family members to go see him. They allowed money to flow to him. They continued to send money to the Taliban. And as far as, well, the reliance on Saudi oil, well, as Christopher Dickey noted, it's not as great as it was, but we painted ourselves into a bit of a corner with our dreadful policies through the Cold War and beyond in the region, but we can get out of it.
Ralph Peters, we're going to come back after a break and talk about how we might get out of it and some of the military logistics. Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you for a minute. Why are we in Saudi Arabia, Jack Beatty?
Well, I think Christopher laid out the reasons. You know, early on in our program, we heard from Robert Hunter, former Clinton administration official, who told us that at the time, in 1990, there was hesitation about basing troops there,
mm-hmm.
and people said, well, we can base them over the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
We can have them on carrier-based capacity and not based on the land there. But the decision was made to go ahead, and it was made to go ahead because the Saudis wanted it. Well, no wonder. We're helping to prop them up. They had a near rebellion of 30,000 tribesmen there last year who were protesting an act of religious discrimination. They crowded into one of their cities with Kalashnikov rifles and forced them to back down. I mean, that's an example. Talk about instability. Imagine if we had in America 30,000 West Virginians showing up to mob a federal official in Charleston. I mean, this
not
is a Yeah.
just wait.
They wanted to take their guns.
One country, anyway, one country at a time, guys. We're talking about Saudi Arabia tonight. And the relationship between the House of Saud and Saudi Arabia and the United States. Our troops are there. Our support is there. Is it well-placed? Or after September 11th, is it time to reconsider? Do you think U.S. troops should be in Saudi Arabia? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Saudi Arabia and the U.S. relationship with that kingdom in the Middle East, that oil-rich kingdom. Our guest is former Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Ralph Peters. He's a former Army intelligence officer and foreign area specialist for Russia and its borderlands. He served in the Pentagon and in the executive office of the president, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. We want to hear from you as well. Do you think U.S. troops should be in Saudi Arabia? Is there another way to defend U.S. interests in the Middle East oil patch? Is there a better way? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ralph Peters, you described Saudi money and Saudi policy destabilizing relatively tolerant Islamic republics around the world, sowing anti-Western hatred. What's the mechanism for that, and what's the impact?
Well, there are a number of mechanisms. One is funding extremist religious schools. Now, much of the Muslim world has been very badly managed. Corrupt elites have stolen everything in sight from Egypt to Pakistan. And you've got a situation where people do crave education for their children. Well, the Saudis provide it. They provide extremist religious madrasas, religious schools. And, you know, the Muslim world does not need more religious scholars. It needs doctors, lawyers, software writers, engineers. But that's not what they provide.
So you see the Saudis at the forefront of this focus on all things religious to the exclusion of science and market awareness.
Well, I think the American government and Americans in general tend to just kind of poo-poo the intensity of the extremism of Saudi Wahhabi religious fundamentalist feeling. Mm-hmm. I mean, what they wanted, trying to do in Indonesia now is destroy what has been a somewhat hopeful laissez-faire Muslim state, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, you've got violence levels in Indonesia that are climbing and climbing. But if I may just say one thing about the discussion just before the break. The primary fallacy of American policy in the region is very simple. It's a Cold War hangover, believing we can prop up dictators, or have to, or that there are dictators. The Shah always falls. Saddam always turns. You cannot prop up the House of Saud forever. And by God, the longer you wait and keep propping it up, the more you are going to alienate the Saudi people and the people throughout the region, where actually Saudi Arabians are hated.
Hated by whom?
By other Arabs and Muslims. I mean, they take the money, but they regard the Saudis as backward and ignorant. Remember that when you hear all about Muslims however long ago building the great cities of Baghdad and Cordoba, mm-hmm, and Samarkand and Isfahan and Cairo, mm-hmm, that's true however long ago. The Saudis never built anything. Speaking of West Virginia, I mean, these people were the hillbilly yokels of the Arab world. They're most backward. And the situation you have now with this windfall oil money coming to the Saudis is as if, honestly, as if the most extreme fundamentalist, snake-handling, hate-filled cousins of the Beverly Hillbillies came into most of America's wealth and can use it as they please to reshape society.
Ralph Peters, we hear your trend there, but take us down to the military logistics here. The Pentagon is there, presumably came in after the Gulf War, presumably because they saw a base in Saudi Arabia as valuable for regional stability. You say not?
Oh, no, I don't disagree with that, that it's valuable. And I even have very few objections to our troops in Saudi Arabia. I have objections to the House of Saud being there. But we had troops, trainers, military trainers, retired military contract employees, tens of thousands of them in there long before the Gulf War. The Saudi military and their National Guard, which is actually separate, they can't repair their own vehicles. They don't want to train. The officers are overweight. We were carrying the water for them for a long time before the Gulf War.
Well, there are a lot of militaries around the world that are not in great shape, but it's not always a threat to the United States. You say that our relationship with Saudi Arabia, not on is not, in fact, in the best interest of the U.S., even though the oil is there. How do you figure that?
Well, because ultimately the Shah always falls. Now, you have to do things by steps. First, we do have to get rid of Saddam and get a more amenable government in Iraq, and that opens Iraqi oil.
Do we need Saudi bases in order to do that?
For now, we probably do.
So it's not time to leave by your lights.
I've never suggested it's time to leave, but I do suggest we need a more equitable and forceful relationship with Saudi Arabia. It's really what we need to do with the Saudis right now is really very simple. Give them the same ultimatum that George Bush gave the rest of the world, and that is you are either with the terrorists or you are with us. But once you get Iraqi oil flowing again, once we get over our you first nonsense with Iran, and open up to Iranian oil again, which, by the way, would facilitate the struggle of reformers in Iran. And even as it is, Iran is much more liberal today than Saudi Arabia is. You get the other taps flowing. Then Saudi Arabia still is important, but relatively not as important. And at the end of the day, I'm just not convinced that we have to respect Saudi sovereignty over those oil fields in a crisis.
Jack Beatty?
Can I put in,
please,
you know, this question about the Bush administration? The president apparently has commented on this, according to Maureen Dowd. He was asked, well, the Saudis sponsor these madrasas. The madrasas teach hatred, the hatred of America, of the West. Can't we ask the Saudis to stop doing this? After all, we're protecting them. And he said, wait a minute, that's wrong. He said, you know, Tim McVeigh was a Methodist, and yet we don't tell the Methodists to stop preaching. That's a desolating observation on the part of our president.
But here we have national policy here, not just Tim McVeigh. But Jack and Ralph Peters, we know the bargain that the House of Saud has struck. They support this extremist Wahhabi sect of Islam because the Wahhabi mullahs support them.
Well, it wouldn't be so bad if they were just supporting it in Saudi Arabia. The thing is, they're so aggressively trying to export it. And with Tim McVeigh was not a country with billions of dollars behind him. He, by the way, actually had diluted but practical goals. The Saudi goals tend to be a little more apocalyptic, but that's another discussion. The most important thing we need to focus on is that the House of Saud isn't going to be around forever. In the meantime, we've got a perverse situation in which we bow down to them. It's not even an equal relationship. Right now, as I'm sure you know, Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally, a U.S. Air Force female fighter pilot, has a lawsuit against the Department of Defense because we force our female service members, when they leave the quarantine of the bases in Saudi Arabia, they have to wear full Islamic dress, they can't drive a car, they must sit in the back seat. Now, that doesn't sound like the way to treat our service members to them. I mean, we are essentially behaving as hired mercenaries in Saudi Arabia.
Ralph Peters, stand by.
But hate the Saudis? Talk to U.S. soldiers who have served there.
Ralph Peters, stand by, and Jack Beatty as well. I want to bring in Judith Kipper. Judith Kipper is co-director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening, Judith Kipper.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. We've got a lively conversation going here, Judith, on the U.S. embrace of Saudi Arabia and whether it's time to reconsider it. Our guest, Ralph Peters, says that this is the most preposterous and wrongheaded policy in American history since the defense of slavery. That is the U.S. embrace of Saudi Arabia. What's your view?
I think we've had an essential and vital strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia since about 1944. In that they have about 25% of the world's oil, and they provide oil to the first to the Western world and now to the global economy at reasonable prices, and we provide protection and later arms sales. So I think that has worked very, very well. But obviously, since September 11th, there are many new elements that have to be considered. And the real question now is, how is Saudi Arabia going to face its internal challenge that those who go overboard in their conservative form of Islam are moving toward violence and suicide bombing, and they are out to get not only the Saudis but the Americans?
Yeah, Judith Kipper, at this point, it's not really just an internal question, is it? We all saw the World Trade Center go down in Flight 93 and in the wing of the Pentagon. Isn't this issue of how Saudi Arabia handles religious extremism now a matter of foreign policy for the United States?
I think what has changed since September 11th is the fact that the Saudi internal dilemma has now become a concern not only for Saudi Arabia, but for the United States and the entire world. And the threat to Saudi Arabia is the same threat to the United States and any other country that may suffer from this particular kind of terrorism. I think what's needed in the relationship now, because internal issues are always sensitive in all societies, is to be very honest with each other. And I think that the United States and Saudi Arabia really have to start in the interests of the allied and strategic relationships, we have to start being a little bit more honest with each other about the things that we disagree about and the things that are now very serious challenges, even threats to both countries.
But Judith Kipper, what kind of ally does the House of Saud make if its very existence in power depends on the support of this virulent religious sect? Perhaps it is fed by the very thing that threatens both it and us.
Well, I don't agree with that premise.
Okay.
The whole point of Saudi Arabia as a state, as a country, as a House of Saud, etc., is based on being guardians of the Sunni faith. Mecca and Medina form that has been accepted for their way of life, their governance, etc., which is extremely conservative.
But then why do they kowtow to the Wahhabi? Why, as Ralph Peters says, do they help spread the Wahhabi puritanical strain of Islam around the world?
There is nothing wrong with their particular strain of Islam, which is extremely conservative. What is wrong is that when people who interpret that particular conservative strain of Islam in ways that allows violence to be done, all religion proselytize, all religions try to set up their schools and their missions all over the world, and the Saudi form of Islam is not alone in that effort.
No, Ralph
Peters, here's a benign view of the Wahhabi version of Islam. What do you say?
I mean, Roman Catholic schools in America are not preaching hatred of Islam or hatred of Europe or anything else. These schools for hatred.
Mm.
What's more, I just don't buy the religious tolerance argument. The extreme Islam and conservative Islam is what has been retarding Islam's development for at least five, probably eight centuries. Now, how can we just say, well, it's all relative, it's just their culture, it's just their religion? They oppress women, there's no freedom of speech, they preach hatred, they kill us. And they're also very hypocritical. Ms. Kipper, what do you think about the absolute squalid hypocrisy of the Saudi royal family once it gets abroad? And by the way, if the Saudis want to come down and say, oh, it's just our religion, we have a right to spread our religion, well, then maybe we should have a few Buddhist monks in Medina, some Christian missionaries in Riyadh. And by the way, in Mecca, there are some great halls.
I don't think this kind of discussion is really very useful or helpful to the listeners or to the formulation of U.S. policy that is going to face the challenges that are before us today.
We can call people names,
and we can make all kinds of accusations and worry about personal behavior in London, and we may or may not be appalled by it, but that's not the issue. The issue today is how do we deal with extremists who are willing to blow themselves up for the sake of either bringing down the House of Saud or simply hurting Americans.
Ralph Peters, Judith Kipper, please stand by. Jack Beatty, you hear the argument laid out here. On the one hand, there's a moral outrage and maybe a little more over Saudi and the Arabia and the House of Saud. On the other hand, Judith Kipper says, let's be serious. We've got to deal with the facts on the ground here.
Well, throughout our history, we've had to deal with unsavory governments. To win World War II, we had to deal with Stalin. So this isn't anything new. But I think the point the colonel makes is well taken, that repressive governments, governments that outlaw political parties, trade unions, governments that persecute religious sects within their own country, as the Saudis do the Ismaili Shiite Muslims, governments that essentially export their terrorism by, you know, or export terrorists by sort of forcing people out of the country, a government like that is it rests on sand. And the issue, I think, for America in Saudi Arabia is reform or what? And reform soon. I mean, if they go on as they're doing, I mentioned this incident that where 30,000 tribesmen appeared armed and dangerous in the middle of a city. Well, what's going to happen when 60,000 appear or more? Mm. And the reason they appeared was religious oppression, which just characterizes whatever they do there. To read Amnesty International's report on Saudi Arabia is to shake your head in shame. I mean, there was an Indian Catholic was beaten in jail for a month. For what? Carrying a cassette tape of a sermon.
Jack, we've had a lot of callers waiting a long time. Let's get a couple in before the break if we can. Marguerite is on the line. Welcome, Marguerite. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear you discussing this because I've been to two meetings since that horrible thing on September 11th with Muslims, American and some from other countries, but lived here for quite some time, and they do mention the three or four things that makes Muslims hate us, and one is their presence of our troops near the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. But the man said, honestly, the worst thing is that they are protecting and holding up the government there. And they feel very, very strongly against that. Many, many people all over that part of the world who are Muslims do feel that. And they also are very fearful of our attacking Iraq again because they say the terrible thing in Iraq is that we have had sanctions for 10 years there that have resulted, according to UNICEF, it says this, 500,000 children dying from lack of nutrition and medicines and clean water, which they cannot obtain because of the sanctions. So the Muslims have been saying these reasons for the hatred of us ever since that time. But there was more emphasis on this even in 60 Minutes right after the terrible attack in New York, but not since that time. But they also don't like that there's always this emphasis on what we're doing with Israel and Palestine.
Right. So we know the list, Marguerite, but let us put it to Judith Kipper. Judith Kipper, what about it now that this religious intensity has come to hit the United States? Can we have the same relationship? And if we can't, is the House of Saud capable of the kind of reforms necessary to cool things off? Or are we buying long-standing enmity that's going to go on for a long time by staying in partnership with the House of Saud?
I think, first of all, you phrase it as a religious intensity. That was not the fact. We were attacked by people who are terrorists, who are doing terror in a false,
well, it may be false, but it's very clear that it's fueled by a certain view of Islam. I mean, we've all seen the record
of... That's right, but I think that if we need to call a spade, and this was a false, fake interpretation of Islam.
False or not, but we've had many reports on this show of how it's bred in
Saudi Arabia, which we will maintain. In order to deal with the challenges, the security challenges that face the United States and our long-term interests, we need to be very, very honest with our allies, including Saudi Arabia.
But what about the question, Judith Kipper, are they capable of reform?
That caused people to go crazy, as those who perpetuated the crimes of September 11th did.
I don't hear an answer to the question of whether or not the House of Saud is capable of reform.
Yes, it is. I would say, yes, it is. If it's going to do it fast enough, I'm not sure. The Saudis, ironically, have suffered a number of very important crises in the last 20 or 30 years.
We'll come back to those after a short break. Stand by, Judith Kipper. We're talking about the House of Saud and the U.S. embrace of Saudi Arabia. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Why are we in Saudi Arabia? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're digging in tonight to the U.S. friendship, alliance, relationship with Saudi Arabia and the House of Saud and asking some hard questions in the wake of September 11th. Do you think U.S. troops should be stationed in Saudi Arabia? Should U.S. troops be propping up a corrupt Islamic theocracy? And after September 11th, can the U.S. support a regime that foments anti-American hatred? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, a former Army intelligence officer in the U.S. Army, and by Judith Kipper, co-director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're also joined by a lot of callers who want to join our conversation. Let's turn there now. Rao is on the line. Welcome, Rao. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, why should U.S. keep the army in Saudi Arabia against the will of the people of Saudi Arabia? Second, who are we to say that we can keep on supporting a government against the will of that country's people? Third, is it right for us to pay the price of World Trade Center just because of that stationing the army in Saudi Arabia?
Rao, you've got tough questions there. I'll put them first to Ralph Peters.
Well, I'll take Rao's third question, actually, the question about the World Trade Center attacks. I think there's much more to that. I actually think that Osama bin Laden is in a long tradition of apocalyptic terrorists, mm-hmm. and there have been Christians and Jews over the millennia.
Mm-hmm.
But what his articulated goals, get the troops out of Saudi Arabia, get rid of Israel, they change from time to time. But no matter what he achieved, he'd be insatiable. He's trying to jumpstart Armageddon. He is beyond the practical terrorists we're familiar with. There's a sort of, you know, we're used to the practical, politically oriented terrorists who hijack planes to have a quid pro quo or to, you know, to get something in return. And so on September 11th, when the planes were hijacked, we thought, well, the terrorists will land them and make demands. But these apocalyptic terrorists are out to destroy.
So if that's the case, Ralph Peters, what does that mean about U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think it means several things. And Judith Kipper's right about one thing. We must achieve a new level of honesty. And to that end, we have to be honest about Islam. Islam is very various, but there's a powerful strain within it today that while we are not at war with Islam, a portion of Islam does believe that they are at war with us. And Osama bin Laden and his acolytes, to them, are absolute heroes. Now, I think the stationing of troops in Saudi Arabia just isn't the big issue. It's a more fundamental issue mm-hmm. than that. It's the failure of Islam and Muslim states and peoples to compete not only in the postmodern, but even in the modern era.
Judith Kipper, what's your recipe for reform, for somehow moving this off the dime and getting our relationship with Saudi Arabia to a more positive place?
I think that with all of our allies, since we're the sole superpower, the United States has to put some conditions, and there has to be a price to be paid. It has to be done quietly, respectfully, in the interest of both countries. But clearly, we cannot continue to wink and blink and look the other way at any of our allies when they are clearly behaving or conducting policies that work against American interests.
So what would your message to Prince Bin Bandar be here, the U.S., the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., or to the Saudi King Fahd? What should be off limits now?
I think they have to begin to look at their education system first and foremost, and I think it will be very, very important in terms of the evolution of Saudi society for them to find ways and means to integrate women into all aspects of Saudi life. Saudi women are highly educated, they go to universities, but they are separate, and I think that's very, very unhealthy.
Can you honestly imagine the House of Saud changing that in our lifetimes?
Absolutely.
You can.
Sure. I go to Saudi Arabia. I know what is being said, what people are talking about. These things are a question of time.
And how would the leaders of the Wahhabi sect respond to an initiative by the Saudi government to take women out of their traditional role in Saudi Arabia?
I think initially they would impose it, and clearly you can't say suddenly everything's going to change overnight. It has mm-hmm. to be incremental, and I think over time, with the different education system, more openness, more contact between the ulema, the religious leaders, the Saudi royal family, the rulers, the government, some dialogue. They have their own traditional mechanisms for doing that. That change can come about. Saudi Arabia has changed. It's very, very slow. It's very private. And we actually know very little about Saudi society internally, so we can't demand that they do what we think they should do. We have to challenge them to do what they think they have to do in order to evolve, because clearly it is time for them to address those issues.
Well, but Judith Kipper, I hear you saying on the one hand, we're the superpower, we need to lay down what's required, and on the other hand, it has to be their choice of what they need to evolve, and that evolution so far seems to have ended up with a pretty ugly situation on September 11th.
No, I don't think that that's the case. I think that's really lumping too many things together. Obviously, the sources of why so many of these hijackers were Saudis has to be looked at it, mm-hmm. in the education system, in the extremist view that gets out of whack and people go crazy and become so fanatic. On the other side, Saudi Arabia's reforms in terms of their economy, their application to the World Trade Organization as a way to have an external pressure for economic reform, and a number of other things. They have weathered quite a lot of crises extremely well in the last 25 years. They have to take other steps, and they have to do it more quickly than is their habit. They are very, very slow moving.
Ralph Peters, just 30 seconds, but your three-point plan for reform?
Right. Well, I'm not sure the House of Saud. I don't believe the House of Saud can reform. I think they're just too far gone. But I would say amid all this complexity, there are some simple things. Some clear things, and that's it. Hey, you know, if you think you are a friend, or say you are a friend and our ally, you don't kill Americans, you don't fund the killing of Americans, you don't subvert regimes that are friendly and hopeful toward America. The Saudis Judas reform she talked about, they basically tried to bribe their way out of everything, and done a fairly good job, but now the money's running out as well. I'm not hopeful for the House of Saud. I am ultimately hopeful for the region. Once the House of Saud is gone.
Ralph Peters, our time has run out, but we appreciate your sharing it with us. Thanks very much for coming on.
I'm honored to have been your guest.
And Judith Kipper, thank you for entering the fray with us this evening.
Thank you.
Judith Kipper is co-director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ralph Peters is a former Army intelligence officer and author of Fighting for the Future, Will America Triumph? Jack Beatty, we've just got a minute left, but there's a hot knot of issues and of views.
It sure is. And, you know, we have to ask about the character of the American government. I mean, it's an oil man who's our president and vice president, and the Bush family relations with the Saudis go back a long way. In other words, that's going to be a barrier for President Bush, just having this candid discussion with the Saudis. And I've already adduced his comment about McVeigh and Methodists versus the Wahhabism.
But one wonders if the momentum that built up so quickly after September 11th will stay strong enough for the U.S. government to change its traditionally kind of tolerant, get-along, go-along relationship with the House of Saud and go in and really ask for more.
Well, we really have to hope so. I mean, September 11th was something serious, and it meant the status quo can't go on. The domestic political arrangements of this country helped to produce September 11th. Those domestic political arrangements remain our enemy in the war on terror.
Jack, we're going to have to come back and look more closely, I think, at the Wahhabi sect and exactly what that means. But for tonight, that's all the time we've got on this subject. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. The Menendez brothers had one. Joan Benet had one. David Koresh had one. Amy Fisher had three. In the 90s, it seemed that nearly every major news story had a TV movie ripped from the headlines. Now, Hollywood is beginning to look at the horrific headlines of this past fall for future Movie of the Week fodder. Brian Lowry covers the television industry for the LA Times. I asked him what Hollywood has in the works.
The biggest of the projects that's been announced so far is a made-for-TV movie that Lawrence Schiller, who wrote the books and did the miniseries American Tragedy about the O.J. Simpson defense team, and Perfect Murder, Perfect Town about the JonBenet Ramsey case, that CBS has ordered. And it would chronicle in real time the 90-some-odd minutes on the ground while Flight 93, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, was in the air.
The man who did the O.J. Simpson TV drama and JonBenet Ramsey is going to now deal with September 11th. Is this seen as a coup in Hollywood or as grotesque?
Probably a little of both, actually, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, when you're talking about made-for-TV movies, you're talking about something that is probably a year away, at least, from getting on the air. There are a couple of other projects that are in the works. One, also dealing with Flight 93, that's in a more nascent stage. The other one is a company that produced the Judy Garland miniseries last year, is working on a movie that would look at the Hamburg terrorist cell. And again, that's not been sold to anyone. That's simply in the talking stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, at a certain amount of time passes with anything, people start looking at these things as stories. And they're obviously extremely compelling stories.
What about the heart of 9/11 as it's come to be seen, the World Trade Center and the disaster in Manhattan? Anyone working on that?
So far, nothing yet. There was a comedy pitched to CBS, a romantic comedy about two people who were brought together because they both lost spouses
mm-hmm.
in the World Trade Center. Again, that has not been ordered. It's just been pitched in script form. So I think people are sort of slowly starting to deal with some of these issues.
Flight 93, I suppose, comes up quicker because it's a more heroic, traditional tale.
Correct. And the Schiller version of the story would not deal with the events on the plane. It would deal with what was going on the ground and the intelligence community getting into action and people realizing what was happening.
So it's not about the passengers apparently rushing the terrorists?
Not at all. The other project would probably deal more closely with that.
Now, why would they avoid that on the plane scene? Is that out of respect, or is there a dramatic television drama principle at work here?
Well, I think in part it's out of respect. I think that is still a little raw at this point. I think the other problem is that it's been documented incredibly well. I mean, one of the things that TV movies run into now is that by the time a TV movie can get on the air about a rip from the headline story, you've had every news magazine under the sun and cable covering it for mm-hmm. months and months and months. And there have been some extremely poignant, you know, Dateline NBC and 60 Minutes pieces and that sort of thing
mm-hmm.
about Flight 93 and some of these stories. I just don't think they can touch it.
Brian Lowry, has there been any hesitation or much hesitation on the part of the networks or perceived by them on the part of the public about seeing the stories of 9/11 turned into TV drama?
I think they've been proceeding somewhat tentatively. You know, where they've been able to do it quickly in sort of incorporating it into the lexicon of television is in episodic dramas. You've seen The Practice do mm-hmm. an episode which dealt with a man of Arab descent who was being held. You've seen NYPD Blue reference it. You've seen Third Watch, which is set in New York and deals with firefighters and paramedics, do a two-part episode, which was interesting, which one was ended on September 10th, and then the other one picked up on September 12th. Mm-hmm. So they're dealing with it in that venue. But I think in terms of actually doing the true stories of it, I think they're moving along very slowly. I think that's why these are the ones, sort of the first you're hearing of it.
How have these ripped from the headlines movies fared in recent years?
Not well. It's one of the another reason I don't think you're seeing it is because this genre has sort of lost its steam. I mean, it really peaked in 1993. That was kind of the year everybody looks back on when there were not one, not two, but three movies about Amy Fisher, mm-hmm. the Long Island Lolita, and none of which did particularly great. The O.J. and JonBenet Ramsey movies last year were kind of an interesting test, and they did just average. The O.J. movie not very well at all, and the JonBenet Ramsey thing okay.
And the betting in Hollywood on 9/11, do they think Americans will want to see dramatic recreations of one kind or another?
I think at this point, no. I mean, I really don't. I think if they thought there was a big, big market for it, you would see tons of things in development, and it just isn't happening. I think they're proceeding very cautiously. I think there's a sense, again, that you know, that you're going to look like a vulture. Not that that's usually a big disincentive, but really look like a vulture without a lot of upside.
Brian Lowry writes for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is